Let's begin. We're gonna start seeing quantum logic, meaning that we're gonna get the analog to the operations in classical logic that we saw when we operate in quantum systems. In particular, we're gonna focus on two-dimensional systems. Now, important, keep in mind that quantum computing is not limited to two-dimensional system. Quantum information processing is not limited to two-dimensional systems, even though in most introductions to quantum info, you will see only qubits. Of course, that's not the case. You can actually make use of the fact that you can do these things in infinite dimensional systems, continuous variables, and people do, even though we won't talk much about in this course. But in this course, people do quantum computing in continuous variables, all right? So no, it's not limited to qubits. There's no reason why we need to limit ourselves to two-dimensional systems, okay? But it is true that it's the most common way of presenting this. And I say finite dimensional, you can use, of course, higher dimensional, but you see the moment you have any finite dimensional system, you can just talk about it in terms of qubits and you should be fine, okay? Make sense? But infinite dimension is a different story. Many of the things that are proven typically are assuming finite dimensions. It is good that you know that you can do things as well with infinite dimensional systems, okay? Other than that, let's take a look at how we're going to encode what's going to be our notation. I have here, I'm going to project the most basic things, and then we move away from them using the board. But the idea is that we're going to have a two-dimensional quantum system, and we're going to define something called the computational basis, right? So this is for logic, and the computational basis is what we will call the ket 0 and ket 1. Okay, they're orthogonal states, and I can represent them in a two-dimensional normalized complex vector. And in particular, for 0, I'm going to call the 1, 0, and 1, I'm going to call the 0, 1. Okay, again, that's the representations of them. And of course, an arbitrary state would be a superposition of those two. Make sense? All right, the first thing that we're going to see is what we call the polygates, notated typically in circuit form as x, y, z. And those are the ones whose matrix representation is the one given here. So as you can tell, the poly matrices are representation for those gates, okay? Make sense? As you can tell, the computational basis that we picked our poly gates to be so that the computational basis vectors are the eigenvectors of sigma z, okay? Now, the Hadamard gate, that's one of the, we're going to see like the most elementary gates in order to be circuits. So the Hadamard gate is given in this representation as follows. And what does it do? Well, what it does is prepare, if you feed it one of the eigenstate of sigma z, what's it going to do? It's going to prepare the homogeneous superpositions of 0 and 1. Okay, if you give it the 0, it's going to be one of them, rotate 45 degrees. If you give it the 1, it's going to be the other one. So 0 plus 1 and 0 minus 1 when you apply that gate. Make sense? All right. If you see, if you feed the 0, is 1 root 2, 0 plus 1. If you feed it the 1, it's 1 root 2, 0 minus 1. Agreed? So it does prepare uniform superpositions. Make sense, everybody? OK. Of course, another basic gate is the phase rotation, right? Phase rotation, what it does is adds a phase to the one component of any vector. Make sense? So 1 root 2 0 plus 1 is going to become 1 root 2 0 plus e to the I phi 1. Make sense, everybody? All right. So the way we represent classical information, and so when we write circuits, my regular lines are going to be qubit channels, okay? So they represent a qubit, but a channel transmitting a qubit, if you want. And classical measurements are going to be so classical information is a double line, so that means a classical bit in the circuit, okay? Classical information channel. So when you do a measurement, think of a destructive measurement, for example. So the qubit arrives, it's measured, and the information goes to the classical channel and goes to be used somewhere else. If it's a non-destructive measurement, then imagine this is a PVM, right? So that gives you a number, and there's a state update here. And the quantum channel gets updated by the update rule of the measurement that you performed. Makes sense? And that's how we represent it. Mm-hmm. Any questions so far? So this is a classically controlled NOT gate. That means, interesting, yeah, of course. Notice, I didn't say it, right? But notice that what does sigma x do? Sigma x applied to the 0 gives you the 1. And sigma x applied to the 1 gives you the 0. It flips the states in the computational basis. So that is the NOT gate, right? The quantum equivalent of the NOT gate. Getting the 0 to the 1 and the 1 to the 0. Make sense? So that's why I said control NOT, classically control NOT. But in general, you can have a classically controlled poly, right? A classically controlled NOT is that you have a classical bit of information, depending if this is a 1 or a 0, apply a sigma x or not. You can make any control one qubit gate like that, classically controlled one qubit gate like that. Make sense? Now another elementary one. So let's move to the two qubit gate. So of course we have two qubits, right? So we're gonna use the Kronecker product representation for the larger Hilbert space. Everybody is okay with understands what the convention is, no? The Kronecker product convention. Everybody? Yeah. Okay. If not, please speak now. Or remain silent for an hour, I guess. All right. So. We have the 0-0 state, 0-1 state, 1-0 state, 1-1 state, and they're represented like this. Again, Kronecker product of the representations of these two. So the CNOT gate. The CNOT gate is a gate that does the same as the classical CNOT for the computational basis, right? So you get A and B, and you end up with A and then the C naught of A and B. So it does this. It's a control knot in the sense that you have a control bit, right? Or qubit in this case, depending on the control qubit. If it's a 0, you do nothing. If the control qubit is a 1, you flip the second. Make sense? And here, you do nothing, you flip the second. Make sense? Now, this is more fun. Oh, by the way, and the representation of the CNOT gate is this. Same as the classical CNOT gate, but of course, those are qubit lines. Remember what I told you that was important, like the double line classical channel, single line quantum channel. Of course, the cool thing is that you can do CNOT gates now when you have superpositions of zeros and ones, and it becomes fun. Make sense, everybody? So, again, in the computational basis, the representation of the CNOT gate is this. Agreed, everybody? Okay. Now, the Toffoli gate is again the same thing, a doubly controlled knot, same as we saw in the classical case. The circuit representation is the same as in the classical case. And the matrix representation in the computational basis is that. Make sense, everybody? Okay. We have the swap gate, which is represented like that. And the swap gate basically swaps the components in the computational basis. Okay? Does that make sense, everybody? So basically, this is what it's doing. It swaps the components in the computational basis from vector one and vector two, from the two qubits that you put in. So this is very obvious, I guess. The change is happening across the two subsystems. Make sense? Everybody? Okay. I have some cannot some mathematical notebook to play, right? With the gates, this is all of them. So if we wanted to do, I don't know, imagine that I want to do a swap between this between K01, for example. So if I do apply to K01, for example, I get this vector 0010, and 0010 is K10. So it flipped between the two. Make sense, everybody? Okay, very nice. Now, something that is pretty cool is, oops, I shouldn't write, shouldn't show you that. So a control node, as we discussed, right? There's a control, in the classical case, there was a control bit, right? And a target bit. So depending on the value of the control bit, you swap or not the bit that you want to act with the CNOT on, right? And in the quantum case, I showed you that is very similar, right? In the quantum case, depending on the value of the first qubit, if you want, you flip the second in the computational basis. Now, what's interesting here, quantumly, is if I ask you, okay, this is, let's say that this is A and B, right? A is the top line and B is the bottom line. Which one is controlling which? Remind me. I know, it's an obvious question, no trick. Which one is controlling which? I just want somebody to tell me.
Above is controlling the below.
Right. Now, the interesting thing, though, is this. So what happens, let me just show you maybe with Mathematica, which is fun. So let's look at the CNOT gate. The CNOT gate is this, okay? You see it? Keep it in your mind. And I'm gonna do this thing. What has this become? Well, maybe you don't easily see it. Maybe I'll just write the scheme. If you apply Hadamard, Hadamard, then C naught, Hadamard, Hadamard, this is exactly equal to the opposite control. So who's controlling which? See what I mean? Well, a Hadamard you can see as a rotation, right? So if you perform a rotation in that Hilbert space, the control flips. So who's controlling flip? Who's controlling who? What? Depends on if you want your reference frame in the quantum case. Does that make sense? And that's kind of cool. That doesn't happen classically. All right. All right. All right. This is the basic stuff, and this is the stuff that we covered, that we should have covered perhaps time-wise in the previous lecture. So I'm gonna switch to board now. Okay, any questions about the basic gates? Yeah.
Would I get the same thing here if I had a CNOT and a swap gate?
A CNOT and a swap gate. I'm not sure now. I will have to do it. I mean, that's easy to check. If I don't want to think, what I want is, I want to compute this, right? So as you can tell here, it swapped, it changed what is swapped, right? What is controlled. And then you want to compare this with a CNOT and a swap. So let's do it. CNOT and a swap. No, not the same. Yep.
Turn it around, do the swap first.
You want to do CNOT first. Sorry, my bad. Well, CNOT first. To the right means first. Yeah. It's not the same. Okay? And we can discuss why. But this is nice to ask questions, to answer questions. It's definitely not the same. Any questions? Okay. I'll keep the computer here in case we want to project more, because it's really nice to answer questions and to, I mean, if we get to Grover, it's going to be very nice because I have some fun things with Grover. Probably that would be Monday, but Okay. Another element that is really important that we model, right? Hold on. I lost connection here. Not Hadamard. All right. Okay. All right. So one thing that is important that we model in a circuit, and also that we understand, I think it was asked by one of you, is how do we perform non-local measurements, right? I mean, I've told you, remember, the quantum teleportation protocol includes a Bell measurement, if you remember. You need to measure in the Bell basis, a bipartite system. How do you write it in a circuit? And that also tells you, in terms of elementary gates, and that also tells you how you can do it in the lab, for example, if you want to do a Bell measurement. So I want to do this, right? Let me write here Bell. Make sure everybody understands that. I want to do a projective measurement on the Bell basis of two qubits. Well, this is equal to, maybe we should actually first do the math and then we write what is equal. So let's operate in reverse first, okay? So if we have a Hadamard gate on A, identity on B, and we do a C naught on some state phi. So this is equal to, well, depending what phi is. So let's see what it does. So if the state is 0, 0. If the state is 0, 1, if the state is 1, 0, if the state is 1, 1. Okay, so if we do a Hadamard first, right, on A, what is, for example, 0, 0 going to become? Can anybody tell me? You remember what Hadamard did? Hadamard prepares the, oh, go ahead.
Plus. Zero goes to plus, right?
No, that would be sigma x. Ah, to plus, sorry. Yeah, you're right. Zero goes to plus. So if you apply Hadamard identity on B on 0, 0, A goes to, let me just write it like that. Agreed? You get that equal superposition. Make sense, everybody? You created a uniform superposition for A. But then we do a C naught on this. So if we do a C naught on that, now it's a control naught. So this doesn't change, right? But this one changes. But look what we had. By doing that to the computational zero, we got the first Bell state. Agreed, everybody? That clear? So this is going to be phi plus, we call it, sub plus. The first Bell state, if I apply to a 0, 0. Okay? Okay, now what happens with 0, 1? Same thing. So this would be now this before applying the control knot, but now I apply the control knot, and the control knot changes, what did I do? 0, 1, my bad. This is after applying, the Hadamard, right? And then I apply the control knot. This does nothing, this flips. 0, 1 plus 1, 0. So that tells me that this thing is the psi plus. Agreed? Everybody, this is going to give me the psi minus. I mean, I hope the logic is clear. And this is going to give me the phi minus. Okay, everybody? So this is cool. That also means the opposite, right? That means that if I apply them in the inverse order, if I apply the inverse of that, right? Reverse order is going to do the opposite. So if I apply HA 1B C naught X to phi plus, that's going to give me the 0, 0. If I apply HA 1B CX to the psi plus, that's going to give me the 0, 1, and so on. Make sense? So that means that if I want to do Abel bases, one quick trick that I can do is that this circuit is exactly equal to doing a C naught first and then Hadamard on one of them, and then just do a regular computational measurement. When I write nothing on it, it means that it's measuring the computational basis. As you can tell, what this is doing is, okay, I have a Bell state, and that Bestel gets transformed into one of the computational eigenstates. And if I measure these two and get 0, 0, I know that what came in was the phi plus. If I obtain 0, 1, I know that what came in was the psi plus, and so on and so forth. And there's a way, for example, to build it in a lab with local operations. Well, local. This is not local, but with easy to implement operations. A control node and a Hadamard and two regular measurements in the computational basis. Make sense? Now you know how to do Bell measurements in elementary parts of a circuit. So if you can, in your lab, implement a C-naught and a Hadamard and just regular measurements, you're done. You have Bell measurements. That's what Alice can do. Everybody happy with that? All right. Now, the one thing that we can do as practice, right? Question.
We, at some point, said that entanglement cannot be created by local.
Correct.
So where's the non-locality?
C-naught. This is a non-local operation. That's important. That's what I said. C-naught is certainly a non-local operation. Make sense? All right. Yeah, C-naught is an entangling gate. Can entangle things. More questions? Yep.
Does this have anything to do with teleportation?
Yeah, well, that's the next thing I'm going to do. I'm going to write the circuit for teleportation, which is way more complicated than that, because this is one of the steps of teleportation. Alice needs to measure in the Bell basis. If you remember the protocol of teleportation, you have to prepare the state in a way. You have a state that you want to teleport, an entangled state, right? And then you want to act on the first part of the entangled standard state you want to teleport, send classical information to the second state that is entangled, and then apply a unitary that depends on the result of a measurement afterwards. So let's write the quantum circuit for teleportation, OK? All right, let's just remember a little table. Write like that. First of all, we have that state, then A, then B, and then we need two classical channels, right? Remember that A and B have a classical channel and needs to send two bits, no, of classical information. Remember teleportation? What are the steps? Should I remind you? Teleportation, we have an entangled state shared between A and B. That's going to start, or we have to prepare it in this channel in between A and B. We got a thing, a cat, that we want to teleport. Okay? And then Alice is going to make a measurement in the Bell basis here. It's going to generate two bits of information. Remember, there are four Bell states, so the result would be two bits. So we need two classical channels, one per bit. Make sense? Everybody? So. first of all, we need to prepare the state. So when we write a circuit, the assumption is always that what we start here is with the zero in the computational basis. Right? So the initial state, we prepare it with the circuit too. So we write the circuit for preparation. Imagine you were implementing teleportation in the IBM computer. Everything starts with zeros in the computational basis. And it's your job to prepare the initial state to begin the protocol. So we're going to do that as well. So we need to prepare. We have here whatever unitary creates from the zero, the arbitrary state. Okay, so this is just the initial state that we want to teleport. And we also want to prepare a shared Bell state. But that's easy, because we just saw the circuit. You need the Hadamard. You need the inverse of that, right? So first, the, what we just saw, the Hadamard and then the C naught. That creates a Bell state from the zeros. Agreed? So I apply. Let me write it here, maybe. The Hadamard, and then a control knot. All right. And then classical channels are still initialized at zero, so nothing in there. All right, so this would be the preparation state. The first channel has the state that you want to teleport. A and B share a maximally entangled state. Make sense? So now the protocol is that Alice now carries out a Bell measurement between these two. Remember? And depending on what C gets, so if C gets, if Alice gets, remember psi plus, when C measures in the Bell basis projectively, then Bob applies. So that would be identity. If it's phi minus, Bob would apply Z. If it's psi plus, Bob applies X. If it's psi minus, Bob applies minus I, Y, which is the same as Z, X. OK, everybody? Remember that on teleportation? Now, let's implement the projective measurement of, on the Bell basis, and that is this circuit. All right, so we have on this line here a control knot first, and then a Hadamard, and then a regular measurement. That regular measurement is the thing that I'm going to store in CZ here, the classical channel. You see the information goes to CZ now. All right, this one is going to go to CX. All right. Make sense so far? Now, the result of Alice's measurement is going to be now in the computational basis. So let's translate. That means that Alice measured in this circuit the 0,0 state. For this one would be the 1,0 state. For this one would be the 0,1 state. And for this one would be the 1,1 state, right? Because Alice is measuring in computational basis. You see, when we write circuits, we want to write everything in operations on the computational basis if we can, okay? Which is, I mean, you would agree with me that this is much easier to conceptualize experimentally than just make a doable measurement, whatever that is, huh? Agreed? You just need a C-naught, huh? It's also called, by the way, you know another name that the C-naught gate has? It's called the Thirac-Zoller gate. Because it was Thirac and Zoller that were the first people publishing a PRL back in, what, 1995? I don't know. Proving that you can have universal quantum computing with things that you can do in the lab. So their paper is famous. It's one of, in fact, Thirac was nominated for a Nobel Prize, right? But before the Zoller got the Nobel Prize as well. There are many contributions, not just one, but this is a big contribution because that paper shows that in the lab, you can do this stuff. You can do C nodes in the lab, no problem, very easily. Okay, makes sense? Anyway, so now we have the information. Now we need to do this. We need to do this part. Bob will apply one of these depending on the classical info that we have. Okay? So this is a control case. So let's see what we have to do here for Bob. So Bob is going to apply now classically control gates depending on the information that he has here. Okay? So the idea is that Bob applies a sigma x if the CX channel is activated, if it's a 1, and a sigma z if the CZ channel is activated. All right, the classical channels can die here if you want. And these two die at the measurement. Say the measurement is destructive. Okay, we don't care what happens. Question, yeah? I haven't analyzed this yet.
It's fine, yeah, yeah.
Okay.
I'm going to confuse with the order.
I see. So let's see if this does exactly what we want, all right? So if Alice measures 0, 0, okay, that means that this classical channel is a 0. The first qubit was measured as 0. This one is also a 0. The second qubit was measured as 0. So these don't get activated. That's the identity map. So in that case, it works. Bob definitely recovers, in that case, the original state. Make sense? In the 0, 0 case. Agreed, everybody? I don't know. Are you OK with all this? Good. If it's 1, 0, what happens? Well, the first bit is going to be, the first measurement is going to be a 1, right? It's a measurement in the computational basis. The second measurement will be a 0. So only this thing activates. So it's a Z. And the X never gets activated. So perfect. It works. It applies the right thing to recover psi. Agreed, everybody? Yeah? Let's see 0, 1. Well, in the case of 0, 1, CZ doesn't get activated. That's a 0. All right, but the X gets activated because second is a 1. So the X gets done, but the Z doesn't. Yeah, that's perfect. That's what we need to do. Agreed? And in the final case, that is 1, 1, both classical channels are going to get activated to 1, and then both gates are going to get activated, the classically controlled gates. So you do an X and a Z, and this is, that's what you were talking about the order here. Is that it?
If that's fine, then that's also fine.
Say again?
I got confused with the order in the circuit, but I forgot that we're hitting them from the state comes from the left to the right.
Exactly. Okay. All right, so are we fine? So first you do the X, and then you do the set. That's what I thought it was the confusion too. Make sense, everybody? Question. So before the question, so this works. This is the right circuit, this is the preparation, and this is the teleportation. Now, you wrote quantum teleportation as a circuit. Question, yeah?
So the first Hadamard and then C naught is to make a Bell state between.
Correct.
A and what's the use of the C naught and then Hadamard between A and then A?
This is that. This is the Bell measurement. Remember that what Alice has to do is a Bell measurement.
I see.
That's what I have here. In the Bell measurement, if Alice gets 5+, then Bob needs to do identity. If Alice gets 5-, Bob needs to do Z, and so on.
I see.
So yeah, this is the Bell measurement. But you cannot just write a magical box Bell. You need to. The idea of writing quantum circuits is to express things in elementary gates all the time. Okay, that's also very nice because it's universal for experimentalists. If you want, an experimentalist, if you just paint a box that says Bell measurement, well, they wouldn't know, right? But they say, well, in my particular setup, I'm not entirely sure how to do it. Well, here are the building blocks. Can you do those? Say, oh, yeah, yeah. Everybody that would want to do experiments in quantum computing, all that they need to do is elementary gates. And then somebody writes the circuit for them. Make sense? Everybody? Yeah.
I'm still having a hard time understanding the meaning of the vertical lines. So what does the arrow mean below the...
The measurement. So if you haven't understood that, I don't think you've seen everything, right? Because that's crucial. So it's important that you tell me these things. Huh? So this is a measurement of the first qubit,
yeah.
right? And that measurement is a zero or a one. Agreed? It's a measurement in the computational basis, so you get either zero or one. Then whatever you get, you put in here. This is a classical channel, remember. Double line is classical channel.
Oh.
So this thing stores a zero or a one. So that means depending on the result of that, you store here a zero or a one. Same here. You measure the second qubit in the computational basis, you get a zero or a one. Depending on what you get, you store the information on the other channel. Makes sense, classical channels.
Yeah.
And this means that I act with a sigma x if the value of this channel is one. And I do nothing if the value is zero. This is a classically controlled x. Make sense? Also classically controlled, not, but. Does that make sense? Everybody understand what this means, classically controlled gates? Only do the gates if the value of this channel is one. Don't do them if it's zero. Everybody happy? And the other lines are okay? The vertical lines here and everything makes sense? Okay. Any questions? Doesn't it feel good to be able to write the whole protocol of teleportation as a circuit? I think it does. I think it does. And now you see, if you express this in elementary gates, you can talk about circuit complexity of this very easily. How big does this become? And that's a notion of circuit complexity. Make sense? Good.
Sorry, when you say elementary gates, what are you referring to?
Elementary gates are the gates that I've told you so far. The ones that are making this circuit.
Okay, but can we talk about universal sets here?
Yes, that's the next thing.
Okay.
Yeah. All right, any questions? All right. Universality. Now, if you remember from classical logic, right, there were so many universal sets that allowed you to do any functions from bits to bits, right? And in particular, even there were one element universal sets, right, that could do it. Well, let me define first universality and then we analyze if it's going to be that easy now. A set S of gates is universal if, now, what do we want? What do we want to do here? Huh? If you have, imagine n qubits, what would you call universal? What would you need to be able to have a universal set? I have three gates. What should I be able to do with these three gates? Yeah?
Make every other gate from them.
But what are all the possible operations that you can do, all the possible functions that map a set of n qubits to a map of n qubits? I bet you could recognize what that is.
Unitary
operation. S-U 2 to the n. The special set. So you see, like the SU is the set of all unitaries that map qubits to qubits of the terminal one, like normalized qubits to normalized qubits. Agreed? Everybody? Is that clear? We need to be able to do any unitary of dimension 2n. Otherwise, it's not universal. I can think of an operation that is a unitary operation that certainly not be able to reproduce with the gates. So you better, your gates are able to span all the universal, all the group SU 2n. Agreed? Yeah, let me write it. A product of gates in S that yields any unitary U in SU 2 to the n. That would be a universal set. Agreed? By definition. I can do any unitary. I'll give you an example of a universal set.
say, that's a universal set. So take C naught and all the local unitaries to all the qubits. Okay? SU2 is all the one qubit gates, all the one qubit gates that exist, about one qubit to one qubit. Make sense? Everybody? Yep.
So 2 to the n, because that's how many states I have, and I encode into like vectors of the dimension. And why SU?
Is the special group of it's all the.
Yeah, why special? Why special?
Unitary. Ah, but because you want to preserve the norm.
Okay.
You don't want to increase the norm of that. Well, I mean, that's the unitary part. You don't want reflections, my bad.
Yes.
You don't want. You want the terminal one.
Why I don't want reflections?
Because you have 1 degree of freedom. It's a global phase, so. Same thing. Make sense, everybody? Global phases should not play a role in your operations because it's the same state. So unitary preserves the norm. Special takes into account the fact that global phases don't matter for us. Make sense, everyone? Okay. So C naught and all the local unitaries for each qubit is a universal set. But that's super cool. That's related to the Dirac solar thing. All the entanglement and non-locality can be taken into account just with C0. That's pretty cool, no? Huh? That you don't need a lot to take the non-locality into account. It's enough. Be able to do all the local unitaries and a C0 and you, between all of them, of course. And that's, you're done. Now, there's a bit of a problem still, right? What is the cardinality of each SU2? How many elements are there in SU2? 5, 9, 12, 1,000. How many? Infinitely many. It's a continuous group, right? SU2 is isomorphic to SO3. So it's this all the rotations on the sphere, right? Agreed, everybody? So this is not a finite group. Well, that's a problem. Because in the lab, you cannot really have infinitely many gates if needed in order to reproduce a state, right? To reproduce a circuit. Ideally, we want something like, NAND. And that's it. We want a finite number of gates in our universal set. Agreed? If you are an experimentalist, you better rely on a set that is finite. Well, that's unfortunate because that's what it is. The operations that you need to do on qubits are not a discrete number, so cannot be spanned by a discrete number of operations. Make sense? So we need another definition. We can have the second best thing, rather, than being able to do truly universal quantum computing, which this is telling you that in the lab, you will never be able to do. The same way that in classical logic, you are able to do quantum computing with a finite number of gates. I mean, in a lab, you can build a computer. The computer you have at home could be a computer, a universal Turing machine, a computer, right? You cannot say the same with quantum computers. In a lab, you will never be able to implement universal quantum computers because you need infinitely many gates to be able to be universal. Yep.
So you can't implement a variational gate where you control the gate by a scalar?
You could implement that, but the problem is that that's not infinite. It's still not infinite. You have experimental errors in those. Make sense?
Wait, what was the argument? Why is this the case?
What, remind me, what case?
So you mentioned that like for quantum circuits, there cannot be universal set.
No, yes, I just gave you one. There cannot be finite universal sets. SU2 is a continuous group.
Yeah, that's fine.
So you cannot have finite universal sets. Make sense? All the universal sets that I give you are going to be infinite cardinality. That's the problem. That's the issue. You see, in the case of classical logic, it was finite. In fact, one even, right? So even if you're noisy when you implement it, it's fine. As long as you're really good at doing one of them, you can do everything. Here, you need to become good at doing all of them, all across your knob. You need to be very good and very precise all across your knob. Yes?
Is it okay to use the generators of SU2 and apply them sufficiently many times to get close enough to the result?
Maybe. Yes. Maybe. That's what we're going to talk about now. Yep.
So why infinite dimensionality? Why continuity of a group is the argument? Because in classical settings, I was also generating uncountably many functions, right?
It's a discrete group. That's the issue. So all the transformations that map C n bits to m bits, that's a discrete group. That's the issue. You can have all the operations with sets of cardinality one. That's what you don't have here. It's important to compare the two. The fact that the values that bits can have are just two of them. They're discrete.
Oh, I see.
Whereas here, the values that the qubits can have live on the block sphere per qubit.
I see.
That's the issue. Make sense? All right. So, of course, your idea is, can we have something that if applied sufficiently many times is going to get arbitrarily close to any state that you want? For example, if I keep applying the generators, at every step I know what generator to apply to kind of draw the curve that the isomorphism that moves one to another, diffeomorphism that moves one to another is applied. So yeah, that's the idea. That's what we're going to do now. Okay. Definition. Approximately universal set of gates. A set of gates S is approximately universal if there exists a finite product of gates such that any unitary U in SU to N can be approximated with any given finite accuracy. So if we want to be precise with this, but you set an operator norm and you do a delta epsilon definition. So I set epsilon to be something, and I give you, I need that, the product is going to be this this amount, this large amount, right, to get epsilon close to any unitary that I have, that I want. Make sense, everybody? So I can give you, of course, to be infinitely precise, you need infinitely many, even in those sets, right? But I want sets that at least allow me, by repeating many times the elements of that set, I can get epsilon close for any epsilon to any unitary in SUN. Okay? Make sense? Everybody? So, examples are, I'm going to give you a couple examples. H, C naught, and the rotation by pi over 4. That is an approximately universal set. Also a very popular one to implement in labs. If you have Hadamard, you have C naught, and you have pi over 4 rotations, that's approximately universal. You can do anything with that. Make sense? Another one is Hadamard, R pi over 2, and Toffoli. Well, again, this is a control knot as well, control knot, right? So you see how the entangling part of it, the part that entangles, of course, a Hadamard doesn't entangle, a rotation doesn't entangle, the C knot entangles. So the rotation doesn't entangle, the Hadamard doesn't entangle, those are local gates, right? The Toffoli entangles. So you need always at least an entangling gate to be able to do everything in SU2.
Yeah.
in SU2N. Make sense, everybody? Any questions? Yep.
You couldn't get by with just using entangled gates and getting rid of the single ones?
No. Oh, that's bad, no. I mean, yeah, with enough of entangling gates, yes, but you want local control too. So I would not say no in the sense that I'm sure that you can have a finite set of entangling gates so that you can have a universal set, but you're going to complicate things a lot. And keep in mind that in the lab, there's a reason why each universal set has only one, because in the lab, the difficult part to do in the lab is the entangling gates. That is the tough part. So you want to minimize the number of entangling gates that you need to implement in your universal set. You want to become really good at doing C-naught, maybe, in your lab. Make sense? Yeah.
Are these rotations around the Z-axis? The rotations that you wrote?
Yeah, those are the ones that I defined above in the projecting. So let me just rewrite it here. The phase rotation. The gates are theta. That is this, 1, 0, 0, e to the I theta. So you add a gate to the 1, and nothing, you add a gate. You add a phase to the 1 and nothing to the 0. OK? Yeah.
Then it also becomes a question of like what does it mean to have good universal set of gates, right? So what's the measure, like depth of the circuit?
Yeah, indeed. The number of gates, as I say here, which is the depth of the circuit. Yeah. For a given, you want to see how it scales, right? For a given epsilon, how does the number of gates scale with epsilon? You want it to scale with epsilon nicely, not exponentially or anything like that. Make sense, everybody? The nice thing, though, is that for people who are interested in complexity theory, I can tell you that no matter your universal set of gates, in finite dimensions, all the scalings are the complexity scales the same way. You're playing with the factor in front when you pick different gates. Yeah. So in that sense, you're safe. You have a universal set, you're safe in scaling for finite dimension. Make sense, everybody? Is anybody here interested in complexity theory at all? Okay, not many. It's a cool topic. It's a very cool topic. In general, resource theories is cool. I know that people here working on things like that. In particular, complexity is a very interesting resource theory, because it's strongly linked with thermodynamics. You know that? Let me tell you one thing. Quantum mechanics has one particular... Imagine that we believe in the Church of the Larger Hilbert Space, which means that, well, there has to be a quantum mechanical description for everything. Right? So in the end, everything is going to be quantum. It's just we're not seeing the big picture big enough. When we see classicalities, we're missing information, right? If we believe in that, can quantum mechanics destroy information? What do you think? I saw a no, but that is correct. I agree. Do we agree that quantum mechanics cannot destroy information? If we believe that there's a lie, or you can say, well, I can give you the coherence. Yeah, but if I believe in the larger Hilbert space, it's a unitary in a larger Hilbert space, right? Again, we saw Neimark's theorem, right? Everything that you see, no matter how dissipative and how much horrible and heat and losses and so on, well, there's a larger Hilbert space where that's a unitary. So all that is happening is scrambling. The reason why you feel that this has been, the information has been destroyed, is because it's crumbled. It's like a paper shredder, right? You put it in a paper shredder, and then you make it very difficult for somebody to put it back together. But you haven't destroyed the information, agreed? The information is there. You just made it complex to recover it. Make sense? Quantum mechanics does that. And then you can characterize that scrambling of information. You see, you can characterize the scrambling of information as how complex is the circuit that I require to bring it back. And then you can talk about work versus energy in thermodynamics. What is work? It's extracting energy in an orderly fashion, in a way that we can actually use to do something. What is heat? Well, it's energy in forms that we cannot use, that is wasted. The information that is lost by the heat part is scrambled. It's still there, though. It's just scrambled. It's going to cost us work to descramble it. So complexity and thermodynamics are very related. Hopefully, you can see that. And people have realized of that, doing things like black hole thermodynamics and complexity operations on Hawking radiation and things like that. And the two things are related. Okay, so just saying that it's cool to think about complexity.
Thermalization, that is weird. How do two things thermalize? I have a thing, I put it in contact with another thing, and they end up having the same temperature. How? The interaction Hamiltonians between different things are going to be wildly different. How is it that they all evolve to the equilibrium state like that? Microscopically, what's going on? Above all, if all of it is a unitary that cannot create entropy, where are the entropy flows? Complexity is very related to that. Okay? Things that are complex enough, circuits that are complex enough, will thermalize things. You see, it crumbles things so much that it looks thermal. Looks like equilibrium. Looks like so mangled that whatever happens to it, it looks like it's the same. Even though it's not, it looks like it's the same. It was so gibberish, still gibberish. See what I mean? See how complexity, the crumbling of information and thermodynamics come together for people who believe in quantum mechanics? Anyway, yeah.
So do you think complexity has anything to do with like quantum chaos and...
Yes, definitely has something to do with quantum chaos, yes. Don't ask me more, but I don't have the time. But yes, indeed.
So it's like integral systems don't thermalize as well.
Like when you have non-integrable systems, right, which is what you need to thermalize, what are the complexity of the evolution of those systems with other things? It's related to thermodynamics, it's related to chaos. All these things are related, indeed. Quantum chaos is an ill-defined thing in many ways. So what is quantum chaos? Do you have a definition?
Well, it's defined for Hamiltonians, right?
No, really. What is the one definition is take a classical system that's chaotic and quantize it. That's definition one.
You can look at the ETH as well.
And what do you get with that?
You probably have to do some numerics to check it.
Well, what I mean is that that's also a classical, like the periodicity. System that takes longer, a finite dimensional system that takes longer to go back to the same point, that is related with the complexity of the system and the operations. So the recursivity and the Poincaré recursivity of things is also a classical concept. We can export it to quantum. Quantum chaos still is a bit iffy what it is. But certainly, one way of thinking about it is complexity. It's related to complexity, indeed. Anyway, whatever, sorry. I mean, it's good to relate these things to other things, I think, so you see the big picture, or at least think about it a bit. The next thing we're going to do, not today, obviously, but the next thing we're going to do, we're going to get to quantum algorithms. So we have how many lectures left? Two?
Or three?
Or three, because Friday is a holiday, next Friday. Maybe it's three, I don't know, let me check. Oh, just two?
Two.
Just two, okay. So I'll try to be, because I want to discuss things with you, and I have to cover two more things. There are three things left in the course, right? One is quantum algorithms. We'll do Grover's algorithm in particular. Maybe Grover's algorithm is kind of nice when you do it on the board. But for the sake of time, maybe I'll project it. It's a beautiful algorithm of the quantum algorithms. Grover's algorithm is a quantum search. Let me give you the popular science view of it. How do you search in an unstructured list? Imagine you have an unstructured list. Example, I give you an old phone book. All phone books contain names and phone numbers. Yeah. The names are alphabetically ordered, so that's structure. So if I give you a name, it's very easy to find the number. Agreed? However, imagine that I ask you for a name given a number. That's not that easy. The best algorithm, classically, is just to go one by one and check. And going one by one until you reach the right one. So if you do it many times, in order to get with probability 99% or more, right, that you got the right number every time, you need to query the phone book of the order of n times, number of entries. Make sense? Grover's algorithm is different. Grover's algorithm is, okay, here's the quantum phone book. Somebody encoded it in a quantum support in a particular way. We'll talk about how. Encoding the information, like writing the phone book, but instead creating a state. And that state is a uniform superposition of all the possibilities, same as the phone book, right? The probability is 1 over n to find one. So same here. We have a superposition. However, what we're going to do with the phone book, somebody gives us a number and say, okay, I want the name. So with that number. So what I know with the number, I'm going to know how to shake the phone book the right way. So I shake the phone book. Of course, before shaking, if I want to randomly pick one and see if it's correct, the probability is 1 over n, that I actually by chance get the right one. Same as in the classical case. But I'm going to just shake it. And every time I shake it, I'm going to increase the probability of success of finding the right one when I check randomly and decrease the probability of being wrong when I check randomly. So I shake it enough times, and then I just open the book and I say, here. And then you're going to get the right one because you're messed with the probabilities. You skew the probabilities to be correct. Does that make sense? That's the summary of the algorithm. And the number of times that you need to shake the phone book scales with the square root of n instead of n. In the classical case, you need to query n times. Here, we will have to query square root of n times. Not a huge increase, but it's an increase nevertheless. Make sense? And it's kind of cool from the point of view of what I'm doing here is just shaking the phone book to redistribute the probabilities and reducing the probability of being wrong when I check randomly. So at the end of the protocol, you will check randomly and you will be right in your random choice. Make sense? That's what we're going to do. And the nice thing about Grover is that it's very geometric. So I can draw Grover's algorithm, which is really nice. So we will see that. I will project it, and hopefully projecting it won't be too confusing. It's mathematically so simple, unlike Shor's algorithm, which you will do in tutorials, which is not simple. But Grover it is, and it's kind of fun, and we will see it. So we will do Grover's algorithm. Then I have quantum cryptography as well. I want you to at least see one protocol of quantum cryptography, because there's the issue of Shor factorizing prime numbers in polynomial time, and that's an issue, right? Because our current cryptography that we use, because it's very convenient, is not really true cryptography. It's based on complexity, again. Problems that are easy to do one way, but difficult to invert to find the solution. Problems that it's easy to check the solution, but it's difficult to find the solution. And turns out that Shor can find the solution easily for those problems. So that would screw up a lot of the cryptography we use. So we need to understand how to get around that. And we're going to check quantum cryptography a little bit. And I want to do quantum energy teleportation as well, a protocol of RQI. And maybe we can do, for those of you interested, afterwards, after the course is done, we can pick a day that we are all free and have like half an hour or an hour discussion one day. Can ask Vindija to book a room or something. Okay, how does that sound? It's ambitious, but I think we'll do it. Yeah.
So like, can I sort the list in like square root of n, or like one search takes square root of n?
It's the same thing. So meaning that to find the right result, you need to query of the order of root of n. That means that I can build another list that is ordered the way I want in that. So that's why it's n times root of n, which is a scaling like root of n instead of n square. Anyway, yeah, it's equivalent.
So general, for general list, it's better to do like once this Grover algorithm, and then like just standard binary search, right?
Yeah.
Binary search takes log n.
Yeah. No. Binary search doesn't. When it's ordered, once you have it ordered.
Yeah. So I will order with this.
With Grover, yes. You would order it with Grover and then binary, and that's much better than
n.
Yeah. Makes sense, everybody? And there's some curiosity that I'll tell you about Grover algorithm as well, and life and wild hypothesis and so on. I mean, it's fun. The topics that are left are pretty fun. They're kind of cool. It's like seeing quantum computing as its finest, like doing things that classical computing, the same way that if you get a calculator, like a two-bit adder, and you make it quantum, you win absolutely nothing by making it quantum other than having fun. We're going to see cases where doing quantum stuff is better. Or at least we believe it's better. Huh? Again, n versus np is not solved, so I have to give you a disclaimer. At least we believe it's better. Shor is ridiculously better because it improves from the prime number sheaf algorithm, improves to polynomial, which is crazy. Yeah.
I think we'll have a classical polynomial solution for factoring.
You're asking me if we will?
Do you think we'll ever discover a classical?
I think not. But that's an opinion. It's like a Fermat's last theorem, right? Until it was proven, everybody thought it was correct. Goldbach conjecture, right? Like a Riemann hypothesis. Everybody thinks it's correct. We don't have a proof. Make sense, everybody? Cool. Let's try to have some fun. We have only 2 days, huh? To have more fun. So let's try to make it work.